1, 2, 3, 4.
And there's something about an unfettered or uncensored id that is so, you know, we all have that fantasy of just doing exactly what we want with no consequences. And so I think when you see an athlete at the peak of their game, just doing that very embodied thing and living that dream, or you know someone has actually, you know, done horrible things that you would never allow yourself to do, there is a fascination there. I had one teacher who said, anyone who drives you crazy or you just cannot stand in life, put them in a play or a scene and the audience will love them. If someone's really gotten under your skin and you have a visceral reaction, I just hate this person, make them a character and they will be everyone's favorite character. And there is something to that.
Today we explore the dark psychology of obsession, guilt, and the thin line between predator and victim. Our guests are two of television's most accomplished architects of high-stakes drama and moral ambiguity. Howard Gordon, the showrunner and executive producer whose work defined a generation of thrillers with 24 and the multi-award winning Homeland, and Daniel Pearl, an executive producer and writer who brings a distinct penetrating depth from his background as a celebrated playwright and his work on series like Accused and American Crime Story. Now they've collaborated on a new 8-episode Netflix thriller launching November 13th called The Beast in Me, starring Claire Danes and Matthew Rhys. The show takes us into the life of Aggie Wiggs, a celebrated author paralyzed by grief after the death of her young son. She's struggling to write, and she finds dark obsession in her new neighbor, Niall Jarvis, a man who carries the cloud of suspicion after his wife vanished. The show is an uncomfortable look at how obsession with another person's darkness can become a way of coping with your own. As Aggie comes to distrust her own perception, we're left with the question, is the real beast the person across the street, or the beast we find within ourselves?
We are, all of us, drawn to monsters. We flirt with death to prove we're truly alive. And if we can't stop, then that small fire we lit might just burn the whole house down, with us still inside.
That was a clip from the new Netflix series, The Beast in Me. Howard Gordon, Daniel Pearl, welcome to the creative process.
Thank you, Mia.
Thank you so much.
So I binge watched The Beast in Me. I always love anything that Claire Danes does. And I know you've worked with her, obviously, in the past. And Matthew Rhys, they're just two, I think, among the most psychologically interesting actors. They can summon all this. Claire Danes' face is like a masterclass. And I'm ready for my close-up, you know, psychotic breakdown that she can summon. But let's go into it. In her character, Aggie Wiggs, she's a grieving mother. She's an author with writer's block and kind of the ghost of her former self. And suddenly this neighbor comes who has his own even more baggage than her. And so at the point that we meet her, her inner life is so clearly broken. And how did you both approach the writing and the show running to follow her search for her own truth and her search for the truth about Niall and how those wove together?
Well, first of all, we need to tell you that this was a spec pilot, which means it had been a pilot that was created by Gabe Rotter, and where the premise was largely with the premise that exists in the current show. But because it's kind of a complicated and I would say it's a very high degree of difficulty, I think Gabe is very open and, you know, as was Netflix, to bringing in some new voices to sort of help shape it. And it was evident from us, and we also haven't had, this was, as you described really well, a moment of such exquisite vulnerability and stuckness. And it was important to us to sort of define that very existential beginning and the details of it that really were very important to sort of develop atmospheric and intellect. Because, you know, how do you render something interior filmically and to communicate the details of the lost child, of the amount of time, of the stuck creative process, and even the exterior, sort of the externalization of the house as a kind of hellish thing that's barely staying together, that's literally flooding with waste and that she can't afford. So those are the kind of the details that we had to sort of carefully figure out how to weave. But, you know, when you look at the first 10 minutes, it can be a horror movie. Like from that moment, a lot can happen. But what's important about it is that it sort of sets the table for what does happen.
Yeah, exactly. And Daniel?
Yeah, I think that was one thing that I really responded to in the initial draft that we sort of inherited to help shape, is her loneliness was so palpable. You know, but as Howard says, you know, grief, loneliness, isolation, when a character doesn't have a scene partner, that's obviously a challenge to get inside their head. And obviously that's one virtue of an actor like Claire, is you can really see it all on her face. But I think every sort of detail in that pilot, as far as shaping, you know, how her external circumstances were mirroring and reflecting her inner world, those were all things that were very important for all the reasons Howard just described.
Yeah, and you mentioned the setting. I mean, I think back to, you know, classic thrillers like Rear Window, where the kind of, well, Rear Window wasn't suburban, but it had that feel.
No, right.
Yeah, it's like this veneer for darkness. And they're so close to each other. Yeah, and at the same time, there's all this kind of distance and rule setting. And at one point, just the little kind of petty things, like he wants a running path. I thought every psychopath needs a running path.
Right. But it could have been a birdhouse.
Right.
It was like, this is, you know, for someone who's accustomed pathologically to getting whatever they want. And, yeah. You know, that was the fun. That was a very fun detail.
And also just the encroachment of, I felt very excited early on about the fact that it was actually a show about neighbors and the encroachment of boundaries and these little, you know, because this is a character, you know, in Aggie, who has, in her isolation and her grief process, built up a lot of figurative and literal walls. And so even a sort of a slight encroachment on that, she bristles much more strongly than any of her other neighbors in the neighborhood. And that was part of the fun, was that he pushes her when she sort of needs to be pushed, because she has built up this kind of cocoon.
I'm also surprised, because it's funny, I'm amazed that none of us, that we didn't even we never referenced Rear Window, because it is so, it's a much better analogy than sort of our default The Shining metaphor.
Yeah.
But because again, that was obviously about the creative process more, but it is about the relationship and what you project kind of in a, kind of not Vermeer, but kind of an Edward Hopper way. Like, what do you look when through the frames and what do you imagine? And neighbors are required. You know, and these are two deeply lonely people who oddly find each other and, you know, use each other, but are also attracted to each other. And that's what the fun is.
Yeah, because in an odd way, Niall is one of the few people who kind of understands her or seems to understand her, or the bloodlust, the thing that's underneath. Mm-hmm. But I think it also has that element of The Shining. I mean, just because she's an author, and what is she really writing? There's the story within the story and, you know, the unreliable narrator of that. So I think, and we get that kind of claustrophobia as well, and the kind of menace in the familiar. And so it has this, I like the pacing very much, because I think that it's very much propulsive, you know, viewing as a, within genre, as you say, it could even be like within horror, but it's not horror. It's a real, these are real things. It's not supernatural. At the same time, it takes its time, because I really wanted to know Aggie's story. And that's something that is revealed gradually. She doesn't even face it. She doesn't actually even know. She's an unreliable narrator of her own life in ways. And so I liked how that came out of a piece. And it wasn't just so fast paced that we didn't honor their lives.
But it's interesting too, like in the thriller trope, and this was something obviously, and during a time when we're seeing everyone's attention span waning and the buyers and the platforms are sort of requiring a much more kind of obvious thing, whether it's a bomb under the counter or someone wakes up and the person is dead next to them. I mean, okay, you're in it. This did require being compelling enough in those small, almost Roman Polanski or early Coppola moments, like The Conversation or The Tenant or Rosemary's Baby, to really set a mood. And it requires some attention from, you know, attention that seems to be an increasingly scarce commodity among viewers. So again, it really was the synthesis of Daniel and Gabe's pilot and Antonio, our wonderful director, and of course, this incredible alchemy between Claire and Matthew.
Yeah, and I guess all these other things that we don't even think about in a way too, like if you're going to make the pacing such that it's exciting, but you're really holding your breath to know what's happening, like music and production design and the costume and how these tell a story that allows it not to be just constantly moving. Like it builds our internal sense of suspense.
That was one area where I think we just really hit the jackpot. I mean, Antonio Campos did such a beautiful job directing it. We had an incredible Lauren Weeks production, our production designer, Vincent, our DP, just in terms of really making the pilot a film, where, as you say, you do lean in with all your senses. I think that was really important, since, you know, for most of the pilot, she's alone, you know, and you don't have the benefit of getting an info dump right away because she's just shuffling around her house. So you have to sort of feel that tension and that loneliness. And that was one thing I think early on Antonio really understood, was just the power of atmosphere. He, I remember early on, he talked about the scene where she's on the phone with her editor walking through the house, and he had a very, it was one of his, the first things, I think when we first met with him, he thought, I know I want to shoot that phone call, because the phone call itself is very you know, pleasant and even loving. It's sort of the one person who calls on the anniversary of her son's death, and this is her longtime editor and friend, and who's alone in her office in Manhattan, and Aggie's alone in her house. And the way he shot it, while the conversation is sort of, you really feel her isolation and the sinister silhouettes and the lighting he shows, she's going around the house, turning off the lights one by one. And you just feel both at once. You feel the sort of humdrum nature of their conversation and also this kind of lurking menace. Even I think there's a few times he shot her from outside the house. And he's a really brilliant filmmaker. And I think all that was, we really benefited from.
And you mentioned just in terms of attribution, I just want to say that Sean Cowery,
who is our
composer. Music is always one of the, because it's sort of the last element. We really very early on insinuated him into the process. Because again, tonally, we were always experimenting and always trying to find out what's, you know, because it is a tricky tone and hitting, and it's easy to lapse into certain false notes or notes that are manipulative. The process was such a, just a wonderfully collaborative one among all of us. And it doesn't, believe me, having done this for now 40 something years, it does not happen very often. And this was a particularly good.
Yeah,
too.
And so how did you both, like, as you're creating the story, how did you write into the charisma of both the leads and their chemistry? Or did you know that immediately? Because sometimes you can have really, like, two great actors, but it doesn't come together. Like, I don't know, have they worked together before?
I don't think they'd even met, even though they both know. They both are kind of have young families and are kind of roughly, but no, they'd only heard of each other. So you're right. The short answer is you don't until you do. And I'm reminded, though, of Claire and Damian Lewis on Homeland, like, until, like, I don't know, the eighth or ninth day. And even in the pilot, they have one glancing scene. So even then, we didn't know. But in the third or fourth episode, when they actually come together, I just remember this vividly. I remember the same thing with Daniel and I. We're looking at like, old, and the kind of, it was pretty much the moment. It was both of them. There was such just respect, professionalism, and they really just brought their better game out. And I have to compliment Daniel. You know, we discussed a lot, and because I think it really bears saying, writing a psychopath is a very tricky thing. Tricky in that there are lots of sort of easy tropes to default into. And one of the things, and Dan, I don't know if your memory is the same, because of course this was many robust, as we say, arguments, collaborations between us. And I think because Daniel coming as a playwright, you know, is used to words, and sometimes I would say a fair kind of volubility. So characters tend to be articulate, and, you know, and I would joke, save that one for your play. But one of the things I personally decoded about Niall was his ability to be voluble or to be expansive, operatic, but also to fall silent. So it really became this Miles Davis kind of syncopation and knowing when he falls silent and when he's expressive, when he's threatening and when he's charming, and this sort of syncopation of his music. And then of course, Matthew's, he was the real surprise. We'd both worked with Claire before.
Yeah.
So this was a treat for all of us.
Yeah, they're two of the best listeners I think I've ever seen. I mean, they're not only great actors, they're so unbelievably hooked into each other in all those scenes. I think that's really a superpower for both Claire and Matthew. It's just their ability to really, it sounds like a very simple thing, but their ability to listen and really respond. So when you get the two of them together, like in that lunch scene across from each other, it was pretty incredible. But no, I don't think we can take credit for that. That was just, you know, you get lucky.
Yeah, no, they're great listeners. And I love to, I mean, I love language, and but you need the people who can perform those lines. I mean, it's nice when things are spare, but it's so nice when you can have something expansive and it's natural and you hear and see the intelligence of the characters. And yeah, so all that complexity comes to the fore. At one point, Howard, you've talked about the series. It's like all the characters, everyone's complicity, right? Even beyond Aggie and Niall, everyone has a sense of complicity. And whether it's, you know, it's even asking us as viewers in some ways, if we're watching the clickbait, if we're in watching the true crime, what's our complicity in it? Because we're fascinated by these monsters, but what does that say about us? It's either we're watching clickbait of fluffy cats or it's true crime. I mean, it's kind of nuts.
Well, I mean, you know, you, again, just to sort of further dip into your own reference, Rear Window, where Jimmy Stewart goes, we've become a nation of peeping Toms. And again, this is in the 50s. And then to imagine how our 15 minutes of fame and just how social media has been an accelerant to and a dissolvent at the same time of the sort of social fabric and the loneliness that we're all experiencing, the polarization and the amplification of our own narratives and frankly, our own inability to listen to the other. So the irony of these two improbable friends cross paths and listen and see each other in a way that no one else does is where the show lives. But yes, everybody is complicit. And as we peeled away the onion or whatever the thing is, as we built the house, we do recognize the half-truths and the complicity and the looking away and the leaning in when it's convenient for our own narratives. And whether it's Niall's father, whether it's Brittany Shelley, or the ex, principally it's these two characters. And God knows what's fun about a sociopath is he's a sociopath. So there's no, you know, there's no normal psychological reconstruction or analysis of what effed him up, you know, in his life. But I think everybody in it has certain layers of, you know, why we've reached this moment because Brittany Snow looked away, because Jonathan Banks wanted to just keep the thing quiet, because Aggie blamed the pizza delivery guy for the death of her child. And it is really about the consequences of looking away, of denial, and that the past and the truth winds up coming home.
I think it's, as Howard said, and you mentioned this in terms of our complicity watching it, is that I really think the show ended up being so much about scapegoating and how much fun and how good it feels to scapegoat. And just because someone's, you know, a sociopath or a villain doesn't mean you can't still scapegoat them. And then obviously collectively, you know, we love finding a villain. We love putting the blame on one person or one thing. We love sort of looking outward rather than looking inward. And I think to some degree, all these characters are doing that. And as you said, you know, what does it say about us as a culture that we love true crime? We love, and I would posit that it's the illusion that there is one bad guy and you can solve the problem that way.
Right.
And I think that's largely, you know, what Aggie comes to sort of reckon with in this story is I think when we meet her, she is fixated on the notion that there is one guilty party in the death of her son, and that's who deserves justice. And she's sort of obsessed with this notion of blame, which doesn't mean that person is without blame. But obviously, you know, we can all scapegoat each other to death. And ultimately, you know, then what? And so I do think that the show ended up really being about that.
And Yale turned me off to Rene Girard. Was The Violence and the Sacred?
Yeah, one of his books called Violence and the Sacred, Rene Girard. He's an anthropologist, philosopher, genius. He passed away not too long ago, but he's amazing. And he writes a lot about scapegoating and sacrificial mechanisms in sort of psychology.
It also reminds me of, I guess, Edmund Burke, The Sublime and the Beautiful. And like whatever is horrific, the cries of animals, but we find within that the beautiful as well. So that's what I think. We love to tickle our fears in these safe ways through stories. I was wondering about how you developed the arc for Matthew Rhys's character, because in some ways, although I don't think he's that similar, but he is, okay, he's the prime suspect in his wife's disappearance. He is a real estate mogul. He has a dad who is a real estate mogul. I mean, I don't think he's like Trump. In some ways, I find him more vulnerable and sympathetic than Trump, but it made me think about this dynamic of the son that comes out from under. And of course, that famous line that I think Trump said he could kill somebody on Fifth Avenue and no one would do anything. And so I was thinking about this, people who can just like get away with things because of the boldness of, well, because they've never had consequences. They've never had to face consequences.
There are far too many models from which we rip, from the Murtaugh family to the Trump Durst and the Ozymandias empire building arrogance. We're talking too obviously about class and privilege, but again, hopefully not in a trite way, you know, the permission that they take or that certain people take with power. And that was certainly an exploration. And even Aggie's own, I mean, look, you know, I know this sounds like a small matter, but it was one that really took a lot of conversation among us. It's like, what is Aggie, who was living in Brooklyn, writing profiles for the New Yorker and her, you know, working artist wife, but not enjoying tremendous success? What are they doing in this living next to Niall Jarvis? And it was a question that had to be asked and answered very carefully. But Aggie's own past was the answer to that question, became all of us aspiring. What do we do when we are tempted by sudden fortune or the market rewards our work? Who do we become and why do we become it? And it sort of made us ask and answer again the question of Aggie, someone who was home insecure, both emotionally and physically, just didn't have a place. So she kind of overreached for this fancy house that she couldn't really afford, but that of course she would afford because of her big three-book contract, which of course she's not been able to fulfill. So that was kind of the trap we wanted to lay for her. But also we had to just explain, what the hell is someone who's kind of a bohemian person living next to a billionaire?
Yeah, and they both have, and she'd externalized the monster in the form of her own, I don't think this is giving too much backstory away, but her own father. So they both shared this kind of overbearing, or a father that like imprinted themselves strongly upon them.
Yeah.
And then they're both rewriting their own story. So now she's in search of a new monster, a new beast. And of course, in killing the beast, we kind of can become the beast. It's the mantle that you have to take on. I was just wondering what drew you both to this story. It's a little different. I mean, it covers some territory that you've touched on, but I think in a much different way. You know, why was it time for you to approach this story?
Daniel?
It's a good question. So I read Gabe's pilot when Claire reached out, because it was looking like it was going to happen. There was a play called Freefall that Claire had come to a reading years ago that explored some similar thematic questions. Claire had remembered that and said, I feel like this story is in your wheelhouse. I love a good two-hander. Anytime two characters can just kind of talk, even something like the lunch scene, those are my favorite scenes to write. There's this kind of cat and mouse dynamic, sort of go at each other. So I think certainly that was very exciting. You know, I love Hitchcock. I love sort of psychological thrillers. The other thing that I found really interesting was that it was a dynamic that I hadn't seen before of a, you know, obviously there was an attraction here, but it wasn't romantic or sexual. You know, Aggie's a lesbian. She's not physically attracted to Niall, but it's almost like these two alphas doing this dance where it was a very unique form of intimacy that I thought was really interesting that I hadn't seen on TV before. I was really interested in that relationship. And also just in the question, I mean, you mentioned Trump. I think whatever you think about Trump, he has an insane level of charisma. You talk about how he's never faced consequences, and certainly there are a lot of people who, because of their wealth or their privilege or their, you know, their family, they've never faced consequences. I do think I would add to that just a certain kind of pure raw charisma that we're all sort of sucked into, and I think that was also something that, again, he wasn't meant to be too similar to Trump, but I think that dynamic of feeling this pull towards someone that you at once are fascinated by but also repelled by in certain ways, I thought that push-pull was really quite interesting and really sort of spoke to the moment that I think we're all experiencing right now.
I think very simply, it's like it's almost more pedestrian than anything. Again, because it is a different proposition coming in at a point during which this is a project that had been living. Claire, again, had been with it and Gabe had been with it for years before. So they'd taken a few paths, none of which really seemed to pan out. And so one has a certain advantage coming in with fresh eyes to a process like that. But again, the compelling, I call it the dramatic molecule, that essential relationship felt, it provoked kind of a fear in me in a good way, in a way that good things, it's not like, oh, you know, there was something not schematic at all about it, but we knew it would require improvisation and a certain music and a certain tone that had to be found. And I think just as someone toward the end of my longest career, there was a relationship and the loss, I mean, being as a father too, I think the whole fun of doing this, and I don't know if it's fun, I'd say the therapy of doing it, is being able to sort of imagine what a situation feels like, what it feels like to lose. What does grief look like? How do you get to experience that dramatically? And maybe, you know, there's a salutary process for you as a writer and as a producer, hopefully for an audience, again, when they can experience something with the safety of somebody else's experience.
What were the moments or touchstones of grief, if you don't mind me asking you?
The touchstones, well, I think everything. It's funny because I think when we started, I remember telling Netflix or Daniel, like every scene is about loss. And so everything is refracted through that. And whether it's her defensiveness, her insistence on the narrative between she and her wife, between the facts of the day Cooper, her son, was killed, between her telling herself that, you know, she's making progress and her own relationship to her work. I mean, it was really like finding the sort of matrix of desperation and defining all those moments and how they collided into this perfect moment where, again, literally her house is coming apart. She cannot write a word. Her house is on the verge of repossession, and it's the anniversary of her son's death, and she is deeper in the hole than she was even 4 years ago. So it was really just defining this supremely lonely person. Now, it's funny, you know, Diane mentioned like the art direction too. And I remember, you know, we wanted this house to be kind of a bit of a shithole, but we walked in the first iteration of it and it looked like a clearly psychotic person lived there. And we were like, okay, let's just dial that back. That right level of, you know, where And I don't know, it's almost like that, whichever senator talked about pornography, I'll know it when I see it. Mm-hmm. So it really was about this negotiation among all of us about what the tone, what was too much and what wasn't pushing it or making it clear enough.
Daniel, did you want to add to that?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a parent. I obviously have parents, and certainly I think that it is sort of the worst thing imaginable to think about. I've definitely experienced times when I felt like I was using writing as a way of avoiding feeling whatever it was I was feeling. And so that was intimately familiar and relatable. And obviously, I think as writers, there's a therapeutic nature. There's also a sort of dissociative, you know, distancing nature of the creative process. And so I thought the idea that this is a woman who writing has always been her escape, and in this moment, even that is failing her. I think any writer knows the supreme loneliness of writer's block, even without grief. And so the fact that even that was kind of failure in this moment, I think, again, something writing about writing is always, you know, a real minefield. It can feel very sort of solipsistic, and it can make you nervous because you want to make sure it's not only interesting because it's what you've experienced, but there's universality to it. And I think that was where her grief, you know, yes, this was her particular art and her vocation, but I think anyone who's lost a child or fears losing a child can relate to the sense of no escape. And anything that you thought was your solace, even that is failing you in this moment.
It's really interesting what she has sacrificed in some ways for her career, or the choices that she makes, that putting her career first. And I guess that we can all experience that. I mean, I think that for those of us in the art, sometimes we become kind of monocular in our vision. And of course, it's for, you know, it's for something to share stories with people, but we can kind of, our personal lives can be sacrificed. I mean, somebody said to me is art can be an addiction, you know, making art, like it can be that. Absolutely. And nothing else matters, and you've got to have your fix, or the fame that comes with art, the readership, or getting that another best-selling book. So, you know, at one point you do crazy things like you would like an addict in a way. You form friendships with a person who is possibly a killer. You let them in your house. You get drunk with them. So it's kind of strange because it becomes, you, Howard mentioned it being a kind of therapy. You kind of asking yourself, what have you done in your own life in the pursuit of a good story? Like, have you, for the creation of this or others, sat down with psychopaths, with killers? I'm sure in your research process, or for Homeland or 24 or The Accused.
Well, I think what you do is develop or cultivate a kind of radical compassion, I would say, for every character. Every character, because when you, even Niall, like oddly enough, I saw this person, and I think that complexity, and again, where is it transactional? Where is it grist for the mill of the creative process? Where is it utilitarian? Where is it feeding some part of you? And it's like separating, does one do charity or give charity? Is one kind for oneself? I mean, these are really interesting questions. And, you know, well, and the fame part is like, again, if you're lucky enough to sort of, you know, have some material reward for your hard work, and which is all you can control, the process, you can't control the result. How much are you nourished by that? How much do you recognize its transience and its counterfeitness? And is, I like to think that I recognize how small, how fleeting fame is, or how fleeting even material success is. And it's hard to sort of invoke that kind of, you know, Buddhist fact that we're just dust and every day could be our last. But again, I'm at a different point in my life than Daniel. So he's on the, I always, it's a running joke between us as I pat him patronizingly on the back and say, good luck.
Interesting. I don't know if you were going to come in there at Daniel, but you know, we've talked about charisma now. We talk about killers or psychopaths or people who really walk that line, but it is fascinating. Like, we want to, as long as we have our distance, watch that. It reminds me of those interviews with the Iceman. And the Iceman, for those who don't know, was Richard Kuklinski, a contract killer, I think from the 60s to the 80s. And there are famous interviews with him in prison. And at one point, the interviewer calls him an assassin or something. And he says, oh, how exotic. And his expression, I mean, they're like actors, you know, really. There's something, I don't know if you've seen that, but he has this whisper of a smile. And it's like, they're on a whole nother level of just, like, what? Just what they'll do. They're just, like, so driven.
It's funny because I'm reminded of being at a, again, this is 30 years ago, at a birthday party for some six-year-old friend of mine's son, 6 years old. And most of the people were academics or physicians in this particular thing. But one of the people was a well-known crime family person. And I will tell you that when we were all, and these are, this is just a group of men, at some point the evening became that. It was like a barbecue or something. People fawning over this man because I think everybody, including me, like had some awareness this person had done these forbidden things, these subversive things that none of us had the guts, desire, whatever to do, but he had. And I think keeping company with those types of people, and this may even lie at the root of some evolutionary thing, somebody who is willing to kill, or you know may have killed, is someone who you oddly feel you're endangered by, but you're also protected by that person if you're in their space.
Yeah, life skills.
Right.
I do think it's interesting because they do say that humans are unhappy because we're detached from our nature, you know? Like we've got so far away from what we started off being and it makes us unhappy. And if we were just like hunting and doing these things, we would be closer to the origins of what we were meant to be. And so I think that, yeah, that might be part of it too. They seem oddly healthy in a way. People who are athletes too, or people who their intelligence is embodied and we kind of more and more disembodied from, you know, our human nature.
Yeah, and I think there's something about an unfettered or uncensored id that is so, you know, that we all have that fantasy of just doing exactly what we want with no consequences, and it's sort of letting that. So I think when you see an athlete at the peak of their game, just doing that, as you say, very embodied thing and living that dream, or you know someone has actually, you know, done horrible things that you would never allow yourself to do, there is fascination there. I remember, this is a little bit different, but everyone, you had asked about being a writer and being drawn to certain things. I had one teacher who said, anyone who drives you crazy or you just cannot stand in life, put them in a play or a scene and the audience will love them. If someone's really gotten under your skin and you have a visceral reaction, I just hate this person, make them a character and they will be everyone's favorite character. And there is something to that. So I think it's certainly in my own life, I've kept many more people in my life who might drive me crazy, but are interesting and fascinating and entertaining. And I do think there's something to it. What does it mean when someone just gets under your skin? There's some sort of heat there that is really good for creativity. There's something that comes alive in you when you kind of want to wring their neck. So I do think that there's something to it.
Yeah, it's a primal instinct. Well, I'm glad you brought up kind of important lessons or teachers, because in a way, also Howard, you're kind of saying that you are a slightly previous generation in some ways. I don't know if you want to say you've taken Daniel under your wing, but you have a creative partnership and it's like one generation inspiring another. Very much if you want to talk about the evolution of your creative partnership from, you know, Daniel starting off writing and then going on to executive producing and show running as well together, just if you could discuss that.
Well, we met in the season finale of in Morocco, actually, on the set of Homeland. Dan was visiting Claire, Ed was on a trip visiting them. And we spent the day on the set, or half the day. I really liked this young man named Daniel Pearl. And that was about the beginning and end of it. About 2 or 3 years later, I had a show that I had developed that was going on the air. Daniel's name crossed my desk. I go, oh, well, is that the same guy I met in Morocco 3 years ago? Long and short of it is that it was. We engaged in this thing. And Daniel wrote a script for the show, this new show. In fact, before it had even gotten picked up.
Yeah.
And it was like, I will tell you, I was transparently, fawningly appreciative. And it is a unique thing because by and large, really, as Daniel has now discovered, you're mostly disappointed in other people's work. People who may have had high expectations, people whose work you've seen or read. And you're like, wait, what's the disconnect? With Daniel's, it was like, holy crow, he's brilliant. And it just got better and better. In that first year, Daniel wrote, you know, leapfrogged over whomever, whatever other cohort of writers, and really kind of in a de facto way became my partner on the show. And then in the second season, became showrunner. I mean, I wanted him. And again, I was very open about my own point in my career. And I said to Daniel, I'm actually enjoying this process. It's the first time it has actually happened across a generation. And we still feel the same way. And it's just really a delight. I will tell you that I have joked with my friends and even with Daniel directly, I feel like the samurai, you know, master who's about to be disemboweled by the student, you know, willfully, or have his head cut off. And I'm very glad for it, because his Daniel's learning curve has been, you're painfully modest, but his learning curve has been so steep. And it's been really wonderful to see it. And again, now that his has sort of got the authority just on the set and with other actors, it's a wonderful process. When it works, it's spectacular.
I feel really just incredibly lucky that I met Howard and we've had this partnership. As he mentioned, I think the other thing that I've really benefited from, I mean, Howard, I think, is also quite modest, but he's not just a veteran, but a sort of legend in his TV space. I talk about, you know, Howard's sort of spidey sense for, he sort of has a sixth sense for when something's funky, it's story, you know, propulsion, you know, structure. Oh, when something actually has legs that will sustain a show. I'm sure it comes from years of 24 when I can't imagine writing 24 episodes of a season. I mean, my head explodes trying to write 8. But I came from originally from a theater background and actually then got into film. I adapted this play of mine called A Kid Like Jake that starred Claire, which is how I met Claire, which is why I was visiting her in Morocco. But I had not done a ton of television. I'd been in 2 writer's rooms before I met Howard. Primarily, most of my experience was in theater and film. One of the really amazing things for me about working on Accused was getting to be on set for production and in the edit room. As people know, in TV, writing becomes producing, and you suddenly are wearing many hats. You're not just writing scripts, you're actually, you know, on the set talking to directors and designers and actors and then cutting the episodes. And so I feel like the fact that Howard was willing to just let me take a crack at it and sort of trusted me to learn by doing was just an amazing thing, not to mention, you know, I think just his mentorship and his willingness to sort of show me the ropes. I think there's no excuse for just doing it, you know, over and over and over again. And I think the other really exciting thing about Accused, that particular show, was that it was an anthology series, which meant that every episode was a different story. It was a different little movie. So in one season, we were, you know, it was every episode had a new cast, every episode had a new director, new story. So we were kind of, I mean, it was crazy, but it was also probably the best training I ever could have gotten, you know, the combination of working with Howard on that particular show, because we just got to do it over and over again on every aspect of the process, from talking to the production design and casting and costuming, because it was a whole new world each episode. And then this has been just an extension of that, which has been so incredibly exciting. I feel humbled and grateful, and I keep learning. So that's very exciting.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned The Accused, Homeland, 24, now The Beast in Me. You know, a common through line I see from whatever setting it is, but it's this moral ambiguity. Like we are rooting for these characters, but sometimes for the wrong reasons. We get lost in the muddiness, which is really interesting, and life isn't clear. And I think, and this is an awkward segue, but I want to talk about the future of television, film, playwriting in the AI age, and the, you know, what this is doing to the way we tell and receive stories, edit stories, the whole thing. You know, we've learned all this stuff, and now let's, in some way, some people are just outsourcing their creativity to these bots, algorithms that don't have our priorities.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you a quick funny thing. I interviewed the journalist Nicholas Kristof, and his reporting, they say, is accountable for saving lives in Sudan, indirectly. And I don't edit with AI, but AI is always there in the background making suggestions. And they said that that detail about saving millions of lives was just, oh, you could cut that. So not our sense of priorities and what's the real story, I think. But okay, so that's a long question. But what do you think about AI? How is that changing the stories we'll be receiving down the line?
I guess for me, the one thing that, and this may be delusional hope, I guess that, you know, it is incredible what AI can do. And obviously the fact that it's kind of incorporated all this text and spitting out, you know, I don't want to downplay what it can do, which is insane. I do think when it comes to the creative process, when I think about the best ideas I've ever had or the best moments in screenplays, I do think there's something just very mysterious about where that comes from. I don't think you can reduce it to everything that's ever been written before and sort of using that to predict what should be written now. So I do think there is, I have faith that a really good screenplay can only be written by a human with a psyche and a soul. Whether AI can write some drivel that someone will watch, maybe. I mean, I don't doubt that it can, even better than drivel, even something that is kind of by the numbers, that it can parrot and mimic and synthesize other works and spit out something that looks like a script. I don't doubt that that's possible. But personally, I think there's, even when you're writing, the best ideas, you just can't predict where it comes from. And there's something a little bit spooky and mysterious. And so I would like to believe that that is not something that AI can replace, but I don't know, maybe I'm too optimistic.
I'm far more gravely concerned, not so much about the creative process as much. I mean, they're all related. I think an audience, I think that criticism, which again, in the Aristotelian sense, was like the job of a critic was to be the gatekeeper for the public's taste and point of view. And the lack of curation and the outsourcing of curation to AI, both in terms of the creation of art, but also in terms of the curation. And like we are seeing, we joke all the time about the algorithm that is dictating to human executives who one could argue are, you know, I don't want to bite the hand that currently feeds us both, but I do think that it is shortening the attention span and lowering our capacity to appreciate art, and that there's a, what's the Freudian thing where there's a
folie à deux.
Folie à deux, yeah, where it's like it's just this destructive dance between two people, two entities that I just, so I have grave concerns. And, you know, as a search tool and as maybe a first draft, I mean, I suppose it could be a tool, but I think there are consequences that none of us, I'm just not smart enough or converse enough. All I know is that I'm listening to a book that a friend just sent me. What the hell was it called? And it's the guy, it's not just some, you know, doomsaying guy. It's like one of the inventors of, if anyone builds it, everyone dies is the name of the book. And the guy, I mean, that's not very promising. And the guy's a lot smaller than me. And no, we're worried about being displaced as artists. His explanation, I'm only halfway through it, but it's friggin' chilling.
That's the real thriller. That's the thriller.
But it's also, I mean, it does beg all these other questions about commerce, about intellectual activity, about sort of, you know, about control and about, so, yeah.
Well, for me, I liken it to kind of fast food, and that's fine and it's convenient and it's packed with calories and all sorts of bad things. And AI is kind of like that. It's crammed full of everything, but you don't have to make an effort. You know, I mean, I want to exercise myself. I don't want someone to exercise for me. I want someone to write my story for me. You know, it's my story. And there's instinct. But this is the thing, because you guys have a lifetime of instinct. And that's kind of hard to read, because that's the kind of data that isn't so easily scraped, you know?
Yeah. But my problem is there are so many things that you watch on TV now, or whatever it is called, that feel like AI wrote them. Yeah. That's my problem, is that literally, if that's the standard by which not just the people, the creative community, such as it is willing to peddle content. Like, fast food's a great example where, you know, there's no care, there's no love, and there's no soul in it. It's just content. Even, again, I actually go back to the linguistic, you call it binging content.
Yeah.
Think about the three words that have entered the vernacular from these streaming things where you're just dumping or dropping or binging. Those are gross words in any other context. And to call a story or a movie content just by definition degrades whatever is sacred about art and about storytelling.
So on that, about what is sacred about art, you know, the importance of the arts, I mean, for both of you, you know, as you think about the future and the kind of world that we're leaving the next generation, what is the importance of the arts and what does it mean to live a good life? And what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
Oh, God.
Wow.
Wow. No, I really want Howard to go first.
Okay. You can think about your answer.
Yeah.
And it's just a cliche, but I desperately want, I actually imagine if I were a young parent, what I would do in this world, in the industry, if I had a young generation that I had some version of curating an environment, and I would really find a community. I'm not talking about a cult or some fundamentalist community, a community that was merely organized around not being at the behest of this thing, which we've seen, where listening was actually a virtue, or critical thinking. I mean, these are things that seem evident, or once upon a time seemed like evident, you know, civic components that just seem to have been lost without any fight. And so I hope we can put some of this genie back in the bottle, or toothpaste back in the tube. And so part of it is just having the composure of reading, of visual art, of having the ability to relate to a static image or something and actually bring the engagement of that process to bear, not just have it fed to you by some glowing pixels.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's something also about, I feel like we're very quickly losing our tolerance to sort of sit with any kind of discomfort. You know, that's the other danger, I think, with all this sort of force-feeding, binging content and phones. And I noticed myself this past summer, I said, I'm going to read Middlemarch. I'd never read Middlemarch. And it was, I had this fear, I felt my reading brain and my patience for denser prose, and it's amazing. But it took me, there was an adjustment period where it was like I hadn't read, you know, a hefty novel in a while, because so much of my reading was for work. And I think these phones and this sort of distraction economy was always pulling you in different directions. So I think that's a real loss. I think there's something about, at least for future generations, I feel like the best creative impulses and ideas often come from the time you're alone with no stimulation. There's something about creating a space where ideas can pop up. And that's something that I think is less and less the case when you're always
stimulated.
That's also a real, and then those sort of ideas that come from your unconscious that are usually the good ones. They're not logical ideas. And so I think creating, at least trying to cultivate rituals, that's something certainly I try to do. And I usually fail a lot because I'm so addicted to my phone and I don't pretend I've solved it. But I think certainly for younger generations, I think that's hugely important, is that tolerance for discomfort, stillness, uncertainty, because I do think that's where a lot of the best ideas come from, is from that space.
Yeah, I think those are such important insights. I mean, and I want to thank both of you for your stories that speed us up, but also slow us down and entertain us at the same time, as really making us think and sit with the uncomfortable ideas and bring us beyond, you know, good and evil. So thank you, Howard Gordon and Daniel Pearl, for inviting us into your imaginative worlds and sharing nuanced, complicated dramas full of moral ambiguity that blur the line between fascination, complicity, and frailty, and remind us what it means to be human. Thank you for adding your voices to the creative process.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Thanks, Mia.
The creative process is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Guest contributing editor was Grace Del Rey. Associate interviews producer on this episode was Sophie Garnier. The creative process is produced by Mia Funk. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoy listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just follow us on Instagram @creativeprocesspodcast and send us a DM. Thanks for listening.